Right, okay, so new election, surprise election, the two manifestos are out. In many ways, you know, people, the manifesto's not that surprising, with the Labour Party defending more of public sector and the Conservative Party more of private sector. What you can do, there's one of the posters there. We can't afford another Tory government. Usual price, 17p. Tory price, 26p. One of the things that this shows is that by the 1970s, both parties are employing advertising companies to make their posters. Of course, it's a little bit of a joke, of course, that you can't really buy things with a Tory price. But they're saying prices have risen very quickly, and some of this is the Conservative government's fault. Yeah, that's as Normand de Bonnegare. And there is Dennis Healy waving a little sign there, which says a little pamphlet there, which says wealth tax. Okay, which is obviously something tremendously important. There was something else important in February 1974. We don't want to have the election. So the hung parliaments and the Labour Party doing better than the Conservative Party in terms of the number of seats. There was also record results for two of the smaller parties. Now, you mustn't get carried away, because even record results, you know, the Liberal Party got three times as many votes as it had the last time. However, with the electoral system, of course, the first past the post, they only got 14 seats in Parliament. But as you can see, when the Labour Party have 301 and the Conservatives 297, those 14 seats are very, very important seats. The Scottish National Party also made a significant breakthrough and got almost 22% of the vote in Scotland. Experts and historians talk about de-alignments. What does de-alignment mean? It means that previously it was considered that many people would vote automatically for the same people that their parents voted for. And this is not completely untrue. I mean, you would knock on the door when you're canvassing and say, "Oh no, I'm sorry, we're Conservatives," you know. And even you discuss with people, you say, "You know, why don't you vote Labour?" I say, "Well, my family's always voted Conservative," and that was considered to be an argument. It wasn't necessary to talk politics, yeah. So it's not completely untrue that there's a de-alignment, and this was sometimes connected in the minds of analysts, at least, with a change in the class system. That working class was not as simple a concept as it had been before. But it also corresponded to other changes. For example, trade unionists had traditionally voted Labour, because the Labour Party was established by the trade unions, are generally more, on a very general terms, more favourable to trade unions. However, the 1970s brought something new, that very often the local, the public sector was much bigger. And so public sector workers in the hospitals or in the local councils or in the civil service could be on strike against Labour Party leadership. Yeah, if you work for the local council in housing or whatever, and your local council is Labour, then it's like your boss is Labour. And of course, when you go on strike, your boss tries to stop you. And so it was no longer simple as a trade unionist to be automatically Labour. And this will continue, and in fact the big winter of discontent, which we'll look at next week, one of the most surprising new things about it was that it was a huge wave of strikes against a Labour government. And that was very important, and the trade unionists, it annoyed them. So, you know, it's our government, but I have to go on strike. It caused quite a lot of political problems. But de-alignment is this idea of the decline of an automatic link between social class and Labour voting. But one of the reasons for this decline is that quite often the non-prestigious jobs were people who were finding they were in conflict with their own Labour local council.
and so on. In any case, the new Labour government was able to stop the miners' strike immediately by making a higher pay offer. There's a little story in this, a little politician's story in this. Just before the election, obviously Edward Heath would have liked to have found a solution to the miners' strike before the election. That would have helped him. And there was a moment when it was suggested by the miners' leader that they could give more money for the miners without breaking the rules by changing the calculations. For example, when the miners come out of the mines, they've stopped working and they have to spend time to wash and have showers. But this is not paid time. This is not work time. And so the miners' line said, what do you think, Mr. Heath, or the government? You know, maybe we could count the washing time as work time for miners. This would mean you can give more money to the miners without it appearing that you're giving in, you see. And this was one of the things they were discussing. And at this point, Harold Wilson had an interview with a newspaper and said, I think one good idea would be to pay the miners for the washing time. And because Harold Wilson had said it, that meant that Edward Heath could not do it. Yeah? Because he would appear to be taking somebody else's idea. So this was sabotage from Harold Wilson in a rather intelligent little way. C'est de bonne guerre. Là, on rentre un petit peu dans la politique politicienne, il faut le dire. Mais c'est de bonne guerre. And it's true, Harold Wilson was very playful sort. He would have enjoyed that, I think. Yes, and these people who are the analysts who are going for de-alignment, this is one of the quotes from them, this is Pew. The electorate had become remarkably volatile, leaving voters more susceptible to issues and less influenced by traditional class loyalties. Now, this is not definitive, but it's not untrue. Remember also that more and more young people are going to university. Now, that's bound to detach them from the political influence of their parents, just automatically. Not absolutely, but it leaves them more contact. People are no longer working in the same job as their parents. Again, there's a general move towards individual decision also. And here you have the Scottish National Party, who will continue to become important right to this day, and there you have their performance from 1945, and this is where you can see then that in fact the first breakthrough is in 1970 with 65 candidates. Remember, for each candidate, you need a group of people to work for them in the town. So it's a sign, the more candidates, the it's a sign of how strong your activists group are. And so in 1970, before really the oil had been much discussed about. Jumping forward a little bit to right to May 1974, there is a symbolic strike at the Imperial Typewriter Company. Now, of course, there are strikes every month, and I couldn't possibly tell you all of them, but this one is symbolic for a number of reasons. These were Asian workers, remember, in British English, when you say Asian, you mean from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. That's what it means. In fact, you can hear, in England, you hear people saying, oh, no, I'm not Asian, I'm Chinese. Well, of course, in France, that wouldn't work. In French, that wouldn't work, yeah. Asian workers at the Imperial Typewriting Company went on strike protesting about receiving lower bonuses than the white workers and accusing the employer of race discrimination. The trade union branch and the shop stewards committee did not support the workers. Nevertheless, the strike lasted for 14 weeks and hit the front pages. Around the town, local branches of the National Front gave out leaflets against the strikers, racist leaflets against the strikers. And eventually the factory was closed. Now, although the strike was a defeat, it became tremendously important as a symbol because this was, well, first of all, immigrant workers, where in parts of the economy where there are just immigrant workers, it can be harder to organize a strike. Because there's less, you know, there's less they're often, when they're first generation immigrant workers, they have less information, less networks, and so on. But secondly, the trade union had clearly refused to support them. And it is after this, which it was followed by a union inquiry, which attempted to attack racist discrimination by sections of the trade unions. Let's say that inside the trade union, the National Trade Union, the anti-racists said, what on earth is going on? We have sections of our trade union who refuse to support workers because they're Pakistanis. So that was the reality. And this was the beginning of a process which will shake up the trade unions tremendously. And whereas in 1974, it is perfectly reasonable to say trade unions sometimes support black workers, but often are not interested, that 20 years later, that was absolutely not the case. Absolutely not the case. And today, any anti-racist demonstration will be getting money from the trade unions. That's the trade unions are at the centre of all the anti-racist campaigns. But it took a while. It took a while. And so there you go. The imperialist typewriter strike. Then an alarm call to anti-racist trade unions, because there are racists in trade unions like everywhere else. And they had more influence than people were hoping that they would have. The May 1974 is also the moment when the Sunningdale Agreement will collapse. And this will be done by a number of tactics on behalf of the loyalists, the unionists. First of all, the Ulster Volunteer Force carries out a series of bombings in Dublin. 33 people are killed and 300 were injured. And an Irish parliamentary committee concluded that British soldiers were involved in the bombing too. But nobody has ever been charged with these bombings. So on the one hand, there was loyalist terrorist activity. And on the other hand, the unionist organisation, the Ulster Workers Council, called a strike in Northern Ireland to bring down the new assembly. And it was successful. This was a rather unusual sort of strike. Many people did not dare to go to work because there were armed UVF paramilitaries telling them not to go to work, which is very convincing. And so in any case, it was successful. It showed the power of the anti-assembly unionist sections. There you go, there's the thing on the new Labour government. And there is the Ulster Workers' Council strike in May 1974, protesting the assembly vote regarding the complete endorsement of Sunningdale. After 2 weeks, the chief executive accepted then to dissolve the assembly. So this was a strike which got rid of the assembly. Interestingly enough, what they did was they suspended the assembly, but then a few months later they abolished it. So it was abandoned for a good while. That is to say that they took back direct rule. We now have a Labour government, and the Labour government, in fact, the Labour approach was the situation is difficult internationally. Everybody may have to make sacrifices. That usually means more you than me. But nevertheless, that idea was that they could keep trade unions to limit wage demands by giving the trade unions other things which they wanted. And here is an important example, the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974. And if you walk into a building site in London today, you will see at the entrance, Health and Safety at Work Act 1974, and some of the rules. So it's still an important law today. I had some information here. Yes, this established a health and safety executive and much more thorough government supervision of accident and dangers in the workplace. The Act stated it shall be the duty of every employer to ensure that, as far as is reasonably practicable, the health, safety and welfare at work of all his employees. That meant that, you know, for the first time, for example, on building sites, wearing a helmet was no longer the responsibility of the worker, but of the employer. And this was certainly this was part of a process of making peace with, making good relations with the trade unions. It's also important, and I have some statistics a little later on. The number of people being killed at work continues to decline throughout the 1970s and the 1980s, and in fact until today. The number of people killed at work today, the biggest killer is the buildings. Even today, that building is the most dangerous of jobs. So this is partly a continuation of the welfare state dynamic. That is, that there's a new area of danger in people's lives which becomes a government responsibility. That is, the government is obliging the employers to do something. This is something which also got into people's minds a little bit. People were a little reluctant. For example, during the 1970s, they introduced obligatory seat belts. And people were very reluctant, you know. People used to think it was a joke, whereas in fact, you know, the number of people dying in car accidents went like this, and introduced seat belts. It was absolutely, obviously, a good idea. But at the time, you know, people used to use, I don't like people telling me what to do, you know, something. So there is something going on there. Internationally, this is an important month, because in August 1974, an international earthquake, Nixon resigns, urging a time of healing. Now, what actually happens is that he is told by his advisors, if there is a vote in the Senate about impeaching you, you will lose. That this is almost always sufficient to make presidents resign. Of course, I'm not referring to any particular situation which might be going on in the world at the moment. Also, a time for new technology. Look at this. This will blind you. CFAX. This is a method by which, with your television and your and a little remote control, which is a new thing in the 1970s, you can press a number. For example, you press 101 or you press 115, and 25 seconds later, approximately, you have the weather on. It's incredible. And of course, it looks like absolutely ancient now, because we're used to, you know, with a mobile phone, you know, getting the weather. We can even speak to it, you know. What is the weather like, you know? I don't know if you play with Siri, you say, and you can ask all sorts of stupid questions and you get answers back. But at the time, the television was doing something because I told it to do it. This was new. This was really felt quite new. And I think from the point of view of the historian, we haven't yet measured, and of course we all have the cliche that, you know, the internet has transformed the world, but that's very vague. We haven't yet really measured what is happening. It'll be a bit later when we really understand it. The IRA planted a bomb in Birmingham in a soldier's pub, and a number of soldiers and other people were killed. However, as a result, these four people were arrested, the Guildford Four, and they were tortured and they confessed, and they went to prison, and 15 years later they were found innocent. So this is the beginning of a series. It gets even worse, actually, because at one point, I think it's Jerry Conlin, and he's being beaten by the police, and he says, give me the names of some more people. And he says, my Auntie Aggie. And it was like almost a joke, you know, my auntie and my uncle and my nephew. And they were put in prison for many years, his auntie, because he'd said that as a desperate sort of piece of... his thinking, he wrote a book about it later, his thinking was, you know, if I say it was my auntie, that's so ridiculous. She's just my auntie, you know, that nobody will ever believe it. But in fact, the atmosphere, well, first, there were a whole number of things that led to this. First of all, anti-Irish racism in the police. that some of the police clearly didn't care which Irishman went to jail. If it was an Irishman, that was okay. You know, really, yeah. And in fact, some of them said this, you know. And Conlon in particular, when he was finally released, it was because his defence lawyer had accidentally found a document which had existed at the beginning, which the prosecution knew, and which proved that he couldn't be there. And that is to say that they were not only wrongfully convicted, but the prosecution did it deliberately. They knew they were innocent from the beginning. So very, very hot, I'd say. It is, of course, In the Name of the Father is the movie, which is, and I think all of them have written about this now. I once met Paul Hill. Very, very, obviously very traumatic, and also from a political point of view, this was not the sort of thing that was going to help the situation in Northern Ireland, because of course when people already massively distrusted British justice and the British police, it was even worse after things like that. They also got an official apology, and I don't know if they ever really got over it. So what's this? Another election, yes, of course, in 1970 then, September 1970, Harold Wilson confirms that a second general election for the year will be held on the 10th of October. They had energy, and a second general election, of course, his idea was, you know, if I'm a minority government, it would be better to have a majority. And so that's what he will be trying. The Labour manifesto for the October election was published on the title "Britain Will Win with Labour." Continues to talk about the broadening of public ownership, the phasing out of private beds, and also promises autonomous assemblies for Scotland and Wales. Finally, the manifesto promises a referendum on remaining in the common market. The Labour manifesto says, if we are elected, we will organise a referendum about remaining in the common market, the European Economic Community, or leaving it. Now, it's very amusing how they put it in the manifesto, because, you know, they say, because we believe in democracy, we think that people should decide in a referendum. In reality, it's because the Labour Party is fatally divided on this question, we prefer to have a referendum. So you have this rather strange parallel between the referendum in 1975 and the referendum in 2016, in that in both cases, the government party is hopelessly divided and therefore organise a referendum to avoid the division. But in the 1970s, it was Labour, and in the 2016, it was Conservative. The arguments are rather different in the two cases. I do recommend that you have a look at this. One of the videos is about a debate in the Oxford Union. It's a debate about the about whether one should stay in the European Union or not. In general, it is the left which is against the EEC in the 1970s, because it's seen as a rich man's club, as a rejection of the justifiable priority which we have for Commonwealth countries, and as the beginnings of neoliberalism. Whereas the British businessmen are generally in favour of the common market. The opposing manifesto, then, to get back to October, the opposing manifesto by the Conservative Party is under the title "Putting Britain First." Putting Britain First, the Conservative Party manifesto. Now, when you're reading manifestos or other such things, you have to be careful with the rhetoric. Now, putting Britain first, from one point of view, it's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, they obviously could not entitle their manifesto "Putting Norway First." So it's kind of obvious. But what is hidden? What is Kiske Tamplisit? If you entitle your manifesto "Putting Britain First," what are you actually saying? You're not giving people information, because, like I say, people knew you weren't going to put Norway first. So what are you actually saying? Why do they have a title of a manifesto, "Putting Britain First"?
Europe later.
Say again?
Europe later. We'll come later.
Ah, no, it's not. The centre of the election is not Europe. So that's it's not, and in fact they're more in favour than the Labour are. No, that's not the implicit thing there.
Unemployment again?
Yeah, no, I think you're looking too far away. It's a little bit like, you know, if we both work in different companies and there's a client here and I say, moi je m'appelle John Molina et lui c'est Michael, moi je suis honnête. Vous voyez, je n'ai rien dit sur lui, mais tout le monde a compris. And that's exactly the same. Putting Britain first, the other party is not putting Britain first. That's what's implicit, yeah. It's an accusation. Because putting Britain first is obvious. Because, you know, what else could you do when you're the government? But so it's really an accusation against the Labour Party. We are the party who, and we are the only party who puts Britain first. Now, these are difficult things to. You need a bit of practice and rhetoric to catch what's going on here. But in general, if something is obvious, then they're saying something else. Huh? Which we do all the time. You know, I don't know. You know, for example, so il faut pas être naïf. C'est une évidence. Qui est là à dire ce qu'il faut ici, c'est être naïf. So in fact, it's a hidden accusation. If in an argument I say il faut pas être naïf, I'm saying you are. But there's really much more personal things behind it. Okay, and the Conservative Manifesto, a very, very interesting rhetoric, yeah? For example, this is from the Conservative Manifesto. We do not believe that the great majority of people want revolutionary change in society. Now, I have to say that no person, nobody, left-wing, right-wing, revolutionary Marxists, or anything else, believed that the majority of people wanted revolutionary change in 1974. So when they're saying it, that what they're really saying is the Labour Party is full of revolutionaries. They can't say that, partly because it's not true. Yeah. So that's what they say. We do not believe that the great majority of people want revolutionary change in society. This is a réduction ad absurdum. That is to say that what you do is you exaggerate your opponent's situation, because then, you know, they can't lose, you know. And we do this in personal lives as well. If you eat three chocolate sweets, you know, somebody will accuse you. You mustn't be eating those with every meal. You know, and in fact, that's just exaggeration. Okay. And the Conservative Party aims at developing forms of savings which are protected against inflation. Remember that I already mentioned this. Inflation, the social group which most hates inflation is the middle class. Because the very rich, they move their money to another country. That's not a problem, inflation. And the working class normally don't have savings, so it doesn't change anything. You know, the middle class who have 50,000 euros somewhere in a bank, they hate inflation, because everything they have is reducing. And so when the Conservative Party say, we are going to develop forms of savings which are protected against inflation, they're saying, hey, middle class people, vote for us. Remember that this has all been spoken in British English. In American English, middle class seems to mean something completely different, what we would normally call in Britain working class, because the word working class doesn't really exist in American political discourse. So, I actually saw this on the news the other day. They're interviewing someone saying, oh, yes, my father was middle class. And he turned out he was a factory worker, you know. In America, that's how people talk, yeah. Whereas in Britain, people use very easily the word working class. And in British English, middle class means you're a teacher or a doctor. You know, you're not right up there, you know, you've got a profession. Okay. This is also, so we got to the end of 1974, that's wonderful. And in 1970, oh, sorry, I haven't even given you the results of the elections. The results of the election in 10th of October gave a narrow victory to Harold Wilson, giving the Labour Party a majority of 3 members of Parliament. The Scottish National Party obtained its best ever result with 11 seats, and this would give it weight in future debates on devolution. Now, these 11 seats for the Scottish Nationalists are very important, because remember, the Labour Party has already promised an assembly in Scotland, and so if they organise the assembly in Scotland, maybe they can get some support from the Scottish National Party on certain issues, because a majority of three is dangerous. First of all, you know, you have 315 MPs. Some of them are pretty old. Somebody will die within a year or two. You know, if you get 300 people over 50, you know, one or two of them will die every year. It's basically the up and down of it. You know. There you go. This is also the time when the first McDonald's restaurant in the country opened in London. It's only symbolic, it's only the first. I remember when the first McDonald's restaurant opened in France, and the general opinion was it could never work in France because we love French food so much. It just goes to show how historians know nothing about the future. This is first published then, to get onto the first published section, in 1974. Well, you have this gentleman at the top left, Linton Kwesi Johnson, who's a poet. And he published his first collection of poems. He's a Jamaican-British dub poet. He had been a member of the Black Panthers in the 1960s, and in the 1970s gained recognition for his writing and performance of mostly political poetry, which dealt with issues such as racism and political violence. And I think what is important about it in 1974 is it is becoming not quite establishment, but recognised. You would be beginning to get some teachers using it in class. It's no longer out of this. And this is also the time when the Good Beer Guide was first published, a very, very tremendously important event. It is a symbol of something, because for a very long time the English were not very fussy about beer. They just drank the local beer. Whereas now, if you go into most pubs, you will expect there to be a good choice of beers. It's become just, this is a little bit like in France. Yeah, people drink less wine today than 30 years ago, but much better quality. People used to drink just a lot of really very bad wine, you know, and people don't in the same way anymore. What else is happening in 1974? Inflation is 17%. Okay, so people are worried about this. This means you're not. It makes your everyday life quite unstable. Yeah, you better buy a washing machine now, because if you buy it in 6 months' time, it's quite a lot more. Contraceptive pills are now available free on the National Health Service. So this is the Labour government doing some social thingies. And the Health and Safety Work, the Health and Safety at Work Act, instituted statistics collecting for work accidents, which is fascinating. That means that before 1974, nobody knew how many people had accidents at work, because nobody was obliged to count. That's a really big reform, because of course, if you're not counting, you can't make reforms which will help, because you don't know anything about them. Yeah. Everybody's accident is an individual question. Whereas if you discover that certain kinds of machine often give the same, then you change the machine to make it safer. Yeah, it's like these wonderful, I don't know if you ever used these guillotine machines. They didn't used to be like that, big guillotine machines, but now they're very, very simple. You put the paper in there, and it will only work if you press these two buttons at the same time. It's very, very simple, but it's perfect. Whereas for many, many years, you just had to press one button, and then every now and then somebody left their hand there, you know. And a very, very simple redesign, you need to press two buttons at the same time, and they're not close together. It's not hard, but you can help people. I have the statistics here. In 1974, 651 people were killed in work accidents. 651 people killed at work in 1974. How many people in 2014? 92. Still, it's still pretty good, pretty big change. Yeah, these are big reforms. It's not small stuff. Health and safety. You know, it's far more people being killed than by terrorism. Of course, it's not quite as spectacular. Now, to be fair, that massive drop from 651 to 92 is partly due to better health and safety regulations, but also due to a big change in work structure, there are far fewer people working in industry and far more people working in offices. And of course, to be killed by your computer is difficult. You know, so it's generally difficult. Okay, beginning of 1975, a little bit of statistics, only one statistic in fact. Between 1963 and 1975, average wages had increased by over 200%. That is to say, average wages had been multiplied by three between 1963 and 1975. Prices had also increased, but not so much, not as much as that. As 1970 arrives, of course, I put the song up for you. The 1970 arrives and the World Cup. Of course, the World Cup comes every 4 years, and so England was going into the World Cup in 1970, hopeful, and they actually produced a song by the World Cup team, which was "Back Home, We'll Be Watching and Waiting, Cheering Every Move." Wonderful song. Well, not really. And in general, if you want to hear really kitsch pop music, football squads is generally exactly where to go. But there's something else here. We have the England World Cup squad 1970 and 2014. And the difference is not difficult to notice, I think. It's just so white in 1970. And this is, why is this? That's complicated. I think in general, the star black footballers in the English football team today are black people who were born in Britain. I think almost all of them. But it is also about a decline in everyday racism. If you had, you know, two top quality black players in 1970, they wouldn't, the football teams wouldn't take them. Yeah, because they wouldn't take them, and in the football grounds for many years there was very vicious racism. The first black player, I think he was in Wolverhampton Wanderers. He must have been such a brave guy, because every time he went onto the field, he would have like thousands of people chanting at him, and the most things I wouldn't even repeat. Just be enough to demoralise anybody. But no, you know, they were very, very brave pioneers there. I can't remember his name even, but he deserves a medal or a football. Okay, so 1975 then. In 1975, Donald Coggan was enthroned as the new Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest ranked cleric in the Church of England. Now, as perhaps you remember, Church of England, the head of the Church of England, nominally is the Queen, except when it's a king. But the real boss is the Archbishop of Canterbury. Fascinating reason, and that is that because the first of the Saxon kings who was converted to Christianity back in the 8th century, I think it's the 8th, was in Canterbury. And so Canterbury is the centre of the English church since the 8th century, which I think is really cool. Donald Coggan, interesting character. He became known as a firm supporter of the ordination of women. Although the first women will become priests in the Anglican Church in 1994. In February 1975, we find ourselves back where we were with the subject of the text commentary we did, or you did, or I did, somebody did. Margaret Thatcher defeated Edward Heath in the Conservative Party leadership election to become the party's first female leader. Mrs. Thatcher, now 49 years old, had become education secretary in Mr. Heath's government from 1970 to 1974. And as I think I mentioned in some detail, obviously a very remarkable event, both for the time that she was leading the Conservative Party and for afterwards, because she's the only politician I know who, when she died, there were parties to celebrate her death. I've never heard that. That's not true. General Franco. of Spain. But, you know, in democracies, it's extremely rare. And, of course, there was also the song, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, which got up to number two. Did I tell you this already? Oh, when Thatcher died, there was a song from The Wizard of Oz, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, which was sold, which was bought by people to celebrate Thatcher's death, and it got to number two in the charts. It was sold a lot. But what was amusing about, although people were often buying it so that it would rise up the charts, but what was amusing about it is that the BBC had a terrible moral crisis. Can we play this on the top 20 show, which is every Sunday? And on the one hand, they didn't want to refuse to play it because that sounds like censorship. And on the other hand, they didn't want to play it because that seemed like they were disrespecting Margaret Thatcher. And so finally, what they did is they played 30 seconds, and then they had 1 minute from an interview with somebody who thought it was a good thing to play it, and 1 minute an interview with somebody who thought they should not play it. So it's only a song, but they got very worked up about it. So with hindsight, the defeat of Edward Heath has been seen as the end of one nation Toryism, an expression used to describe the conservatism of the great post-war boom, when Tory governments were happy to cooperate with trade union leaders, work with a broad nationalised sector, very low employment and relatively high rates of income tax. This one-nation conservatism had been relatively stable until the arrival of the deep economic crisis of the 1970s, when companies found it much harder to make high profits. The pressure to reduce taxes and therefore reduce public services was much stronger, and Thatcherism was encouraged by this development. It's very important to remember that the ideas that Thatcher came to represent always existed in the Conservative Party, but for a long time they were minority ideas, either because people thought there was more you could do with one nation Toryism, or simply because they thought that, you know, politics is the art of the possible. This is not possible right now. But they came to represent the Conservative Party. After the end of Thatcherism, under Cameron and so on, the situation was rather ambiguous. From one point of view, they kept a lot of the ideas, but for many years, the Conservative Party did not celebrate Thatcher. They didn't say, vote for us, we're the same as Thatcher. They tended to say, you know, well, let's not talk about Thatcher, because she did manage to become rather unpopular. There was a major tube station crash which killed 43 people. Again, this is something which was improving gradually. If you look at surface train transports, trains across the UK, the 1950s saw 350 deaths in rail accidents. The 1960s saw 176. Of the 1970s, only 73. These are, again, aspects of the welfare state, which are not the first things we think of. But, in fact, health and safety regulations in rail transport were helping along. As we come into the referendum, things get a little bit complicated. There was renegotiations with the European Economic Community, and Harold Wilson declared that he was pleased with the concessions which the Europeans had made. Now, it seems that they didn't really make many concessions, but they made a couple of symbolic concessions to allow him to campaign for a yes vote in the referendum. We have this situation again today, this week, with Theresa May negotiating about the European Union. So, in any case, the referendum was being prepared, and Harold Wilson's government was supporting a yes vote, keep Britain in Europe. However, the cabinet was divided. Several ministers were against Europe, mostly for left-wing, against the European Economic Community. I must not do that, because people always talk as if Europe and the EU were the same thing. Europe's just a place, you know. There's lots of other things. And Harold Wilson made a rather strange decision. Well, it was an understandable decision. He said ministers can campaign for whichever side they prefer. And so you had a situation where you have this referendum, and the Prime Minister is in favour of a yes vote, and several ministers are campaigning for a yes vote, and other ministers are campaigning for a no vote. This is generally a situation which prime ministers prefer to avoid, because electorates do not like divided parties. Yeah? And so you can lose support in that way. But it worked out. It was a slightly unusual situation, because the deal was ministers may campaign for a no vote if they wish, against the opinion of Harold Wilson, but they may not in Parliament defend a no vote. Not in Parliament. They can go out and campaign in meetings, but they can't in Parliament. And Tony Benn, who was the left-wing member of the Labour Party, avoided this by quoting, and he said, you know, the honourable member for, I can't remember where, said last week this, and he was quoting himself at a meeting. You know, that was rather clever. So the aim of the referendum, fundamentally, to stop the Labour Party from dividing, yeah. And there you have the Keep Britain in Europe, and the other one Out and Into the World. And the official government's pamphlet, which went to every home in Britain, Britain's New Deal in Europe, Her Majesty's Government is designed to recommend to the British people to vote for staying in the community. The Labour Party, well, as I said, was very divided, and indeed they held a special one-day conference. And the one-day conference for the party, now remember, you've got the Labour government and the Labour Party, and they're not the same thing. And the Labour Party conference voted against, by almost 2-1, only 7 of the 46 trade unions present at the conference were in favour of an EEC membership. However, it had been decided that if the party votes by more than 2/3, then the party will campaign. But in fact, the no vote had a majority of just less than 2/3, so the party did not campaign. Many, many individual members of the party campaigned for a no vote, and a few individual members of the party campaigned for a yes vote, but the Labour Party did not campaign. Which was kind of handy for Harold Wilson, because it would have been a little bit embarrassing to be the Labour Prime Minister saying yes when the Labour Party was campaigning for no. This is an amusing cartoon mocking the no votes, because the no votes included left wingers. You can see there Tony Benn at the front with a pipe, and holding the banner on the right, Michael Foots. But also against the European Economic Community were the Scottish Nationalists, Trotskyists, the far right, etc. Now, of course, that didn't mean that they had anything in common, but it was City de Bonne Guerre to say, oh, yeah, vous avez la même opinion que les fascistes. It's a form of political attack, which is not so unusual. April 1975 was also an important moment in the Vietnam War. The Viet Cong army took Saigon, and the last US military advisors fled, ending the war in Vietnam. Absolutely earth-shattering event. There's a tiny country defeated the most powerful military country in the history of the world. I mean, you can't overestimate it. It's like, wow. it's a bit like if there were 50 CRS arrive to arrest you, and I throw them all out of the window. Yeah, it was like that sort of thing. You know, it was a massive situation. The reason that the Vietnam War collapsed was, what, first of all, the Viet Cong and their child soldiers, who were very good. Secondly, the morale, the anti-war campaign in the United States, which became absolutely massive. And finally, the morale and the drugs in the US Army, as all three of them together. Also, they had a tremendous amount of disciplinary difficulties in the United States Army. That is to say that the sergeant would say, next week we're moving to there, and then the following day he was dead because his soldiers had killed him. You know, that's a disciplinary problem. It could become that. I don't know what the numbers were of officers killed by their soldiers, but it was hundreds. It was just a huge thing. It was no longer possible. Okay. The referendum. 65% of voters went to vote, and 67% of these voters supported Britain staying inside the EEC. Big political change in June. Tony Benn was demoted from Secretary of State for Industry to Secretary of State for Energy. Tony Benn is the most well-known leader of the left of the Labour Party. He was very much involved in encouraging workers' cooperatives. He was a great supporter of nationalisation. He was the leader of the left of the Labour Party. He was very much... He later became much more left-wing, in fact. He was a member of Parliament for a long time, and he retired at one point, and he said, why are you retiring from Parliament? He said, I want to spend more time doing politics. And you could see him at any demonstration. He was always there. Interestingly enough, you would also see him at a demonstration where there were 20 people because somebody had been sacked. It was a small demonstration, 20 people, and he would be there. He was a tremendous guy in my view. Now, when he was Secretary of State for Industry, he was targeted by a Bath media campaign that the Sun had on its front page, Sack Ben. And when he was transferred, the Sunday Mirror headlined, Bye Bye Ben. So this was a very significant move. In fact, Harold Wilson was trying to, his private eye, yes, the conservative humorous magazine. So Harold Wilson was reacting to the attacks, and certainly by moving Tony Benn away from Secretary of State for Industry, which is a much more important role, he was making the right wing of the Labour Party happy, and making the left wing of the Labour Party very unhappy. So very, very significant. The video which I've put on the list from Tony Benn is more important than the others, because Tony Benn and Roy Jenkins, you need to see those. You need to know who they are, yeah, because they are. And more than just he's on the left wing, you know. Interesting story, Tony Benn, because he was born into an aristocratic family, and he automatically became Lord when his father died. And he had a big problem because he was a member of Parliament, and members of lords are not allowed to sit in the House of Commons. And so he was sacked, de facto. And he led a long campaign to change the law to allow a lord to reject his aristocratic title. And Tony Benn won. It took several years, and he was the first aristocrat to reject his aristocratic title so that he could be a left-wing member of Parliament. It's quite a story. It's a fairy tale, really, isn't it? You know, it's like the princess who becomes a Bolshevik or something. The opening of the National Railway Museum in York. The first national museum outside London. Okay, this is an important thing, cultural policy. Well, the Labour Party boasted at the time that they were the first government with a Minister for the Arts. This is interesting. Previously, art had very often been left to local governments, or not very much money done anyway. And the number of arts museums has rose very much in the 1970s. It was becoming, and this is normal, people had more education, and people who have, although, you know, a lot of people don't like art museums, nevertheless, people who have had more education are more likely to feel that they would like to go to an art museum. And in fact, they found in London that the more museums you open, the more people go to museums. You actually create the demand when you open the museums, which is fascinating, I think. And certainly the Tate Modern today has millions of visitors every year. The Equal Pay Act came into effect at this time, yes. So this is the Equal Pay Act 1970, but remember that when you vote a bill into law, it does not immediately take effect. and in this case it affected some time later. So very important reform, because of course before this, you open the newspaper and you say, we want, a receptionist, £40 for a man, £30 for a woman. It was written in the newspaper. Yeah. There was nothing secret about it. And that was something that ended up shocking people. Now, there was still a long way to go, because the law was not always applied. And secondly, it was realised that very often you had certain jobs where there were only women and the pay was very bad, but you couldn't... It was not direct discrimination. It was like just... typists were all paid badly, whereas another job, which had only men, was paid quite well. And in fact, in some ways, the jobs weren't more difficult or anything. It was just indirect discrimination. And this was much later in the 1990s and after 2000, that there were new laws to deal with indirect discrimination. That is, that not just the same job, but jobs... equivalent jobs needed to be paid the same. And there's been a lot of reforms. Noticeably, there was a case where they found that in the schools that they had women cleaning the schools and men cleaning the school gardens and yards. And the men were being much better paid because it was considered to be a different job. But in fact, you know, there's a point, and that got sorted out. And today, that's being tackled. But after 2000, not in the 1970s. Yes.
Was the Equal Pay Act a direct result of the
law?
The strike by the women
I don't think it's a direct result, but the strike certainly brought up, encouraged the. I think the committees inside the Labour Party were very influential, but certainly it certainly helped a lot because it made everybody talk about it. Whereas a lot of people would say, "Oh yes, I'm in favour, but let's not talk about it." It could have taken several years more if there hadn't had been that sideway. But also more generally, the women's movement was making people think about these things, because even people who were against the women's liberation movement would say, "Yeah, we better give them equal pay, or it helps the feminists." Yeah, not having unequal. But so you got all sorts of bizarre things going on. This is also the moment of the cultural ground zero of the 1970s, the Sex Pistols' first concert in November 75. And punk was to become an aesthetic rebellion against upbeat national unity in the crisis. And of course, the No Future aesthetic and the celebration of the loser. Notice the difference between the 1960s rock and roll narrator, the Beach Boys, you know, we get around, all the girls want to go out with us. And the punk narrator, you see, that where the narrator of a rock and roll song had often been a confident young man about town, and the narrator of progressive rock, a deep, poetic dreamer, the typical narrator of the punk song was a sarcastic loser. Such refrains as, "We're so pretty vacant and we don't care," "On a la tête vide, on s'en fout," with a sarcastic voice, and punk rock introduced sarcasm into popular song for the first time. Or "There's No Future in English Dreaming" became massively popular among young people in a society of stress and unemployment, where the optimism of the post-war boom no longer seemed appropriate. Punk widened considerably the range of themes which popular music dealt with. There was a much wider range of themes, often pretty gritty and or depressing. So there's wonderful. No, there are not just the famous anthems. There's wonderful songs about how I hate my cousin because he's perfect and he gets good marks at school. That's that kind of subject, which is quite sharp in a way. And also a particular treatment of sexuality, which had something to say. Interestingly enough, and perhaps even bizarrely, of the different genres of the 1970s, glam rock, progressive rock, punk rock is the one that leaves more space for women artists. Which is not the first thing you think of, but in fact, now all popular music milieu of the 1970s are massively male-dominated. But in punk, there was space for women, and there's some very successful all female groups like the Slits and the Raincoats, who would really do something with that, and also Polystyrene from X-Ray Specs. These were the punk heroines, if you like, of the 1970s. And we've got to the end of the 1975, which is pretty wonderful. I'll have a little bit more, and then I have a little bit of information there. In 1975, social spending amounted to 19.4% of gross national product. In 1960, the figure had stood at 12.4%. So this is what we say. This is the welfare state. That's what it looks like. So much more money. And also, of course, the gross national product in 1960 was much smaller than the gross national product in 1975. So let's say that general expectation of who would be looked after, whether it's against work accidents or retired people or unemployed people or education, quality of education, more universities for people, that's all welfare spending. Much bigger. You can see there the two examples of the rise of the demand against discrimination against homosexuals. And notice you say that the campaign for homosexual equality declared that it had 6,000 members around the country. And that's a fascinating campaign, quite a moderate sort of campaign. It's not like ACT UP or the Gay Liberation Front. But what's interesting about it, when they said the campaign for homosexual equality, they didn't dream of the right to marry. Nobody even asked. It was so far. Nobody even thought about it because it was just so far. So it's like, you know, and we all want a Rolls Royce as well. You know, it was just there wasn't even a campaign because it seemed so impossible. And certainly the passage by the Conservative government of the gay marriage and the victory in the Irish referendum for gay marriage are some of the most surprising things for the historian. Also, other situations in the British Parliament. I think all the Catholic MPs voted for gay marriage, and all the Muslim MPs as well. So it's really a complete change of what's going on in that particular issue. Finally, for today, Angela Rippon, and there she is, became the first ever regular BBC newsreader. This is important. You watch the news every day. It's a voice of authority. I will explain the world to you. And having only men, it's not a detail. It's not a detail, you know. And Angela Rippon was the first one, and she was greeted with a number of sarcastic comments in the newspapers and so on. Yeah. Thank you very much for your attention. You all still look approximately alive, and I will see you next week at the same time.